sick mind can call Palestinians human animals, a language which incites genocidal actions. It's time to drop the policy of controlled chaos in the Middle East.
The war has killed more than 15,500 Palestinians so far, including at least 6,150 children. Due to Israeli bombardment, about 60% of homes in Gaza have been destroyed, while at least 50,000 families are now homeless.
Hundreds of demonstrations have taken place in solidarity with Palestinians in Italy since October 7, and more will be held in upcoming days in different Italian cities, including Turin, Genoa and Oristano. Max Civili, Rome.
Leaders meeting with Basij volunteers. On Wednesday, 29th of November, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had a meeting with Basij volunteers, which took place at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in Tehran. At this meeting, which takes place every year on the occasion of Basij Week, the leader described Basij volunteers as a very valuable inheritance bequeathed to us by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. In this programme, we discuss the leader's remarks and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. Commenting further on Imam Khomeini's foresight, the leader said, "The Imam's foreknowledge and foresight meant that he correctly recognized, in order to make the country less vulnerable, there was a real need for a massive people-based movement, the Basij volunteers. The Islamic Revolution and the country belongs to the people, and the people can best defend the revolution and the country." Ayatollah Khomeini added, "The logic of the Basij was to maximize the resistance and the resilience of the country vis-à-vis all sorts of dangers and threats. Today, the same logic applies. The existence of Basij is necessary for a comprehensive spiritual and material defense of our national identity, of our national security, and the interests of the Iranian people." In fact, the Basij volunteers' 45-year track record shows clearly the foresight, the wisdom, the insight and correct understanding of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. Turning to the sacred defense era, Ayatollah Khomeini said, "There are times when presence of the Basij volunteers determines the destiny of the nation, a case in point being 8 years of sacred defense. Certainly, if the Basij was not made up of ordinary people, then the outcome of the sacred defense era would have been very different. To summarize, the 8 years of sacred defense was a wonderful and colossal display of the power of the people in the form of Basij volunteers." As well in his remarks, the leader said, "Basij is a culture and a way of thinking." He went on to enumerate some of the characteristics of the Basij, such as its faith, its commitment and willingness to accept responsibility, the fact that it is made up of ordinary people, its revolutionary character, its propensity to help the weak and to stand up to oppressors and tyrants, and its willingness to serve all of the people. The leader poignantly added, "Efforts of young Basijis are very praiseworthy indeed. When flood strikes, Basij volunteers are seen knee-deep in mud, helping to clean up the mess and repair the damage to homes. But Basijis never asked the homeowner, what is your name, what is your religion, or what are your political preferences, what is your ethnicity. They never asked these questions. They just served the people. And that is all, and that is very important. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader commented on another important feature of Basij volunteers, namely their transnational character, making their presence felt well beyond national borders. And, in the language of the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, the Basij are the core or the nuclei of world resistance. Ayatollah Khomeini added, in the language of the late Imam, the nuclei of world resistance are indeed the Basij volunteers. They are not our Basij volunteers, they are global Basij volunteers. But they all have the same culture. The nuclei of world resistance became a reality. Today you can see with your own eyes examples of this in our own region. The same nuclei of resistance that Imam Khomeini had foretold and predicted are today shaping the destiny of this region. One obvious example is the Palestinian resistance and the recent Al-Aqsa storm operation. Ayatollah Khomeini poignantly added, the new map of the Middle East, which the Americans were promoting, has now shown to be total failure. This new map of the political geography of the region, which was drawn up according to US interests and US needs, has failed abjectly. The Americans wanted to destroy Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, and clearly they have failed. Commenting further on the political geography of the Middle East, the leader talked about the fake dichotomies which had been imposed on this region, disappearing one by one. The leader added, fake dichotomies such as Western and non-Western, Shiite and Sunni, the myth of the Shiite crescent and spread of Shiism throughout the region. Ayatollah Khomeini pointedly added, these were all false dichotomies suggested by Westerners, and they fell apart one by one. Who helped the Sunni Palestinians the most, both before and after the Al-Aqsa storm operation? Shiites, of course, the Shiites of Iraq, the Shiites of Lebanon, both Arab and non-Arab Shiites. The false dichotomies crumbled, and in their place, a new dichotomy took shape in this region, the dichotomy of surrender or resistance. Resistance means resisting the coercion and the excessive demands of the United States of America. Resistance means not surrendering to America's coercion and force. Now, some people have 100% resistance. Others show 80% resistance and some show 50% resistance. But quite clearly, resistance is a movement which is clearly seen in the West Asia region. But on the opposite end, diametrically opposite, is surrender. Surrender is a shame and a disgrace. The surrender of nations and governments is shameful and should never happen. Commenting further, Ayatollah Khomeini said, the Al-Aqsa storm operation was an important and unique event which shamed Western civilization. The brutal and barbaric response of the Zionist regime to the Al-Aqsa storm not only shamed and humiliated the Zionists themselves, but it also shamed the United States, and it shamed a number of European countries, and even more generally, it shamed Western civilization. When Israel uses white phosphorus bombs to kill thousands of Palestinian children, American and European politicians stalwartly declare Israel's right to self-defense. But is this really self-defense? What sort of a civilization defends this barbarity and carnage? The crimes and atrocities that we have seen during the past 50 days in the Gaza Strip and elsewhere are a microcosm of the crimes and atrocities which the Zionists have committed during the past 75 years in the land of Palestine. They built their illegal settlements by bulldozing and flattening Palestinian homes, by destroying Palestinian farmlands. Anyone who stood up to the Zionists was murdered. For the past 75 years, the Zionists have been doing this. The fire of the Al-Aqsa storm operation will never be extinguished. The status quo will not last, and with God's grace and provenance, the Zionist regime will be gone, and Palestine will be liberated forever, inshallah, God willing.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
By the Elders, a group of independent global leaders working for peace, justice, human rights, and a sustainable planet. The group was founded by Nelson Mandela in 2007, which includes the former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Calling on Israel to stop the murder of Palestinians is a good thing, but how to go about that to prevent that from happening is another. Watching a genocide happen, for it to stop, and then for it to resume with full force is itself unprecedented in history. As soon as the pause ended, the Israeli killing machine continued with its carnage, and within the span of a little over 24 hours, it murdered over 700 Palestinians. The rate at which Palestinians were being murdered, however, has come into focus. How could Israel kill so many Palestinians? How did it know what to target? That answer came in what is now known as the Gospel. it has been revealed that Israel uses an AI, artificial intelligence program, named Gospel, to select bombing targets in Gaza.
I think a good year to look at to understand its beginning with relation to Gaza is 2019, when the chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi, introduced this new division in the military called the Targets Division. And its idea was to bring together hundreds of soldiers and basically start to develop these AI algorithms and automated software to accelerate the target creation for strikes with life and death consequences in Gaza.
This was revealed by the head for military affairs, Aviv Kochavi, an interview before the war. He said the Gospel was a machine that produces vast amounts of data more effectively than any human and translates it into targets for attack. He added, to put that into perspective, in the past we would produce 50 targets in Gaza per year. Now this machine produces 100 targets in a single day, with 50% of them being attacked. This may explain why Israel has bragged about round-the-clock airstrikes and how it targeted, for example, 600 Hamas targets in a span of 24 hours. Even so, the end result is a complete failure. The data-driven factory has resulted in massive Palestinian casualties.
We're pursuing Hamas wherever Hamas is hiding, in the north and in the south.
The Israeli military spokesperson's statements made one thing clear. Israel's warning for Palestinians to evacuate to the south was an empty promise, since Palestinians were being targeted in the south also. Israel is trying to put on a show of caring for lives with the repeated but false issuance of warnings, this time in the form of grid maps. Israel has started using this new grid system, which breaks Gaza down into more than 600 blocks and can be accessed through a QR code on leaflets and social media posts. But how are Palestinians, who don't have anything except the clothes on their back, going to retrieve and follow these maps? What is becoming clearer by the day is that Israel crammed the Palestinians in the southern part of the Gaza Strip with the intention to push them into Egypt. Egypt thinks that is the case, that Israel is attempting to push Gaza's Palestinian population into the Sinai. Yet the U.S. has said that is definitely not the intention. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has said, under no circumstances will the U.S. permit the forced relocation of Palestinians from Gaza or the West Bank, the besiegement of Gaza, or the redrawing of the borders of Gaza. Even Israel has been quiet on this issue, issued a statement saying that it does not have the intention to forcibly move or remove Palestinians. In the meantime, the Israeli army has divided the Gaza Strip into sections. This is while the fake border with the occupied territories was being pushed further into the Gaza Strip, decreasing the landmass of Gaza. This may indicate Israel's desire for creating the so-called buffer zone, which may then have international forces there. Just as Israel is cornering innocent Palestinians in the southern Gaza Strip, the U.S. is cornering itself with its all-out support for Israel, which may ultimately pose a challenge to Biden's presidential aspirations. But then again, what's more important, Palestinian lives in the hundreds of thousands or the political life of Joe Biden? Since the creation of Israel, the regime has tightened its political and economic grip on the life of Palestinians. In 1995, under the Oslo II Accord, an interim agreement was reached on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The agreement envisioned the establishment of a Palestinian interim self-government in the Palestinian territories. It divided the Israeli-occupied West Bank into three administrative divisions. Restrictions on economic activity in Area C of the West Bank have been particularly detrimental to the Palestinian economy. But Israel's continued attacks on Palestinians there, the demolition of their homes and businesses, uprooting olive trees and checkpoints, have choked the economy.
Israel has proposed zeroing out Egypt's debt, or portion of it, if it allows Palestinians from the Gaza Strip to resettle in the Sinai Peninsula. something that Egypt has rejected outright. You see, Egypt is currently mired in a debt crisis. It owes more than $52 billion to multilateral institutions, at least 44.7% of it, that is, which is owed to the IMF alone. Now, the other proposal that is thrown about is the forced Israeli transfer of Palestinians from the occupied territories of the West Bank to Jordan, especially since Jordan already hosts a large Palestinian population and it has signed a peace treaty with Israel. Apparently, that is why Amman announced recently that it plans to beef up its military presence along its long border. The Jordanian PM has said producing the conditions that would lead to forcible displacement by Israel is tantamount to declaring war on us. All signs in the occupied West Bank are pointing to Israel's intent. Since October 7, these are the stats. 3,200 Palestinians arrested, over 250 killed, more than 1,100 displaced from their homes. And in terms of demolitions, there have been more than 890 since the start of 2023, 139 since October 7. It's an open secret that Israel wants all of Palestine and wants all of the Palestinians out of Palestine. Israeli officials have come out back-to-back making suggestions on the forced displacement of Palestinians, which is a war crime in itself. The latest was the Israeli intel minister, who said instead of funneling money to rebuild Gaza or to the failed UNRWA, the international community can assist in the cost of resettlement, helping the people of Gaza build new lives in their new host countries. Now, this is ethnic cleansing disguised as humanitarianism. And finally, U.S. military assistance to Egypt and Jordan cannot be forgotten. Both countries rank in the top five when it comes to U.S. military assistance, which is another way for these two countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, especially when it comes to Israel. These figures show U.S. aid to Jordan, Egypt, and Israel. The amount of aid going to cash-strapped Egypt and Jordan is not something that the two countries can give up that easily, which is something the U.S. can actually use in the forced displacement of Palestinians as a temptation.
Weeks of relentless Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip has raised concerns about the health situation there. The World Health Organization has warned that more people could die from diseases than from bombings in the Gaza Strip if the health and sanitation systems are not prepared.
Actually, we will see more people dying from disease than we are even seeing from the bombardment if we are not able to put back this health system and provide the basics of life, food, water, medicines, and of course fuel to operate the hospitals.
Critical infrastructure in the besieged territory has been crippled by fuel and supply shortages and targeted attacks on hospitals and the UN facilities since Israel launched strikes on Gaza on October the 7th. All key sanitation services have ceased operating in Gaza, which raises the prospect of an enormous surge of gastrointestinal and infectious diseases among the local populations, including cholera. For Gaza's 2.3 million residents, half of whom are children, finding drinkable water has become close to impossible. The WHO has recorded more than 44,000 cases of diarrhea and 70,000 acute respiratory infections, but real numbers may be significantly higher. Diarrhea increased by 45 times compared with the same period last year, and other diseases from respiratory infections to hygiene issues such as lice have risen. Almost three-quarters of hospitals in Gaza and two-thirds of primary health care clinics have shut down because of damage from hostilities or lack of fuel.
No medicines, no vaccination activities, no access to safe water and hygiene, and no food. We saw a very high number of cases of diarrhea among infants. And again, there was no treatment available for them. You know, if you have a child with diarrhea, you need to give them rehydration in order to keep them.
The health needs of the population of Gaza have increased dramatically, but they are now being serviced by one-third of the hospitals and primary care clinics. And with severe overcrowding, the risks are increasing for epidemics of respiratory tract infections, acute watery diarrhea, hepatitis, scabies, lice, and other diseases.
Health facilities in the Gaza Strip have borne the brunt of Israel's brutal war. Officials have described the situation in northern Gaza as catastrophic amid a lack of medicine and fuel.
The situation is very difficult. The patients, the injured and the martyrs are lying on the ground. The medical staff is not enough and there are no treatments. My brother is injured and his condition is very difficult. We wait all day for treatments and medications. There are no medicines and medical equipment.
They say hospital beds are completely full and wounded people are lying on the ground. Experts now warn the humanitarian crisis would deepen fast if Israel started bombing Gaza again, because people have been so weakened by almost 2 months of attacks. UN officials have warned that alleviating the crisis requires the urgent entry of additional aid and supplies in a smooth, predictable, and continuous manner to lessen the unbearable suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. Despite the temporary truce agreements between Israel and Hamas, officials in Gaza say no fuel had arrived for generators at hospitals in the territory's north. They say that without fuel, the territory could not pump clean water or clear waste accumulating in the streets, warning of a potential public health catastrophe.
Pursuant to the health status in the northern Gaza Strip, only 3 hospitals are still operating, but they cannot cover the health requirements inside the Gaza Strip, as these hospitals are small and there are 900,000 people left. In addition, the health situation in the northern Gaza Strip is currently desperate because of the inaccessibility of medical aid and fuel to the hospitals in the north.
United Nations Children's Funds is also working on creating safe places for children, but it needs a longer break in fighting to heal.
Threats to children are very much from the air and now very much on the ground. He was terrified as a medical professional in terms of the disease outbreak that is lurking here and how that will devastate children who are immune systems and lack of food already is making them perilously weak. Again, anecdotally, as a non-medical professional, when I'm in hospitals, yeah, it's children with wounds of war and it's children with gastro and who are sick everywhere. And I meet a lot of parents who are medical professionals or at least have master's degrees. They know exactly what their children need. They don't have access.
Meanwhile, UN reports said Israeli bombardments have destroyed or damaged 60% of homes in the besieged territory. It's said in Gaza City and North Gaza specifically, intense bombing has resulted in damage to over 50% of all buildings. The report said the strikes have also caused widespread damage to roads and essential infrastructure, such as power systems and distribution networks and water supply equipment.
Kissinger, influential American politician and career diplomat, has died at the age of 100. Kissinger served as both National Security Advisor and Secretary of State under President Richard Nixon and continued as Secretary of State under Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford. However, he left a dark legacy ranging from supporting dictators and terror squads to directing coups and ordering war crimes. Kissinger is known for his role in carpet bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War, which caused the death of 150,000 civilians in a neutral country. The indiscriminate bombing campaign was expressed in Kissinger's infamous order to an American general when he said, quote, anything that flies and anything that moves. The civilian death toll in Cambodia was more than those killed in U.S.-led wars against several West Asian countries over the past 2 decades. Kissinger's genocidal campaign also enabled the rise of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge dictatorship. Yet, ironically enough, Kissinger was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize for ending a war which he had blood on his hands. Kissinger was also involved in a CIA-hatched coup against Chile's socialist leader Salvador Allende in 1973. The coup was followed by a regional campaign of political repression and assassination in South America dubbed Operation Condor. That resulted in the killing of 50,000 people, as well as disappearance and imprisonment of nearly 500,000 people in several South American countries under U.S. ally dictatorships. Kissinger also supported former West Pakistan dictator Yahya Khan, whose army carried out a massive genocidal campaign against Bengali-speaking people in East Pakistan that led to the 1971 war and finally the creation of Bangladesh. Kissinger's other infamous moves include his support for Indonesian leader Suharto, who invaded East Timor in 1975. Tens of thousands of Timorese people were killed in two decades of occupation initiated by Suharto. Kissinger also presided over a writing of a secret national security memo in 1974 recommending the U.S. government to force depopulation of third world countries to weaken their national power, ensure America's access to their resources, and prevent young population rising against U.S. imperialist control. After leaving government in 1977, Kissinger remained a prominent voice in foreign policy circles for decades. Even into his late 90s, he continued attending global events, consulting business clients, and privately advising American presidents. He has been lauded for his incredibly sharp memory and unique analytic powers, but his bloody record is a testimony that superior human intelligence combined with inferior moral sensitivities can be a source of incredible evil rather than good.
Hidden Files.
Being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugar cane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers, and some analysts say the American-European front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule. During a time when slavery was the norm in many countries, Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed, and those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States, and he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to this story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about it's 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. It's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has a has this really deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for such a country that for a country that is so small and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. The U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is the longest, one of the longest occupations in the region, very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. And you have to, so you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? It's, if you your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative, met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004. The year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti. And the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protests, set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that Black people, these Black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, there's you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think ever, you know, so if you see that, and then you see all the WikiLeaks files which were released, and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying, we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, I mean, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which is barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S.-led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent a military, U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. The way they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war, so a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in Haiti, the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, it took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that. But under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded in 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group the membership has fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States. And they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France, after he was elected, to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did, you know, in Libya and Algeria, and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out day by day how this coup d'etat happened from 2000, you know, from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in and they make him, you know, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations, right? So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's a definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. So for example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations. But what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back, that you have this coup d'etat. I mean, not to be fair, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991. 9 months after he was elected by landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country. He said that amount would now come to $21 billion. The following year, Aristide was overthrown in a coup and flown to the Central African Republic by the Americans. After the coup, the United Nations sent in troops who would remain there for 13 years, leaving a legacy of death via cholera and insecurity. 2021, President Jovenel Moïse is assassinated. 2022, currently, Haiti is not being run by an elected president, but a group picked by the international community, who many would say prioritize the needs of Western countries and corporations, not the Haitian people. Currently, Haitians are on the street, and the IMF is trying to force the government to take away gasoline subsidies that would pressure the people even more.
Well, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Pierre, now. Dr. Pierre, give me a little short history of the damage you feel that's been done to Haiti by colonialism and the colonialists.
To win this independence, Haiti had to fight against the French, the Spanish, the British, the Americans. It's like they were all helping each other. And so if you ever visit Citadel in Haiti, where, you know, it's built at the top, you can see all the cannons that they had that acquired from the various European forces that were fighting them. And so that tells you that from the very beginning. But the other part is, it is, you know, the French, of course, you know, it's the gold franc that it took, which really impoverished the country, because then in order, and the leader at the time felt that he needed to do that in order to get recognition, right? This was a country that had to fight a scorched earth war against this superpower, and they were enslaved Africans with no weapons, right? And they were able to win. And so by the end of this, there's nothing left, you know, on the ground, and they have to start from scratch. But no one would no other nation would recognize them, right, for a long time. And so this president thought that maybe, you know, if they go ahead and pay France, that they would get the recognition so that you can have trade and so on and so forth. But then in paying that, it just meant that it was you're impoverishing the country because, you know, it got so bad. And then they had to get a loan from the U.S. to pay off the French. And so they didn't finish paying that till very recently. Right. So you can see what this means in terms of paying a debt for your own freedom. Right. The paying the European, paying your former enslavers money because you dare be free. The U.S. is very much implicated in this. And I do think the Europeans work together. And so I call it like, you know, pan-European, like white supremacy, because they do work together. But the U.S., you know, the first thing with the French is the image of Haiti that emerges out of this period, right? So you have a brutal uprising, but they're representing it in the media, in the Western media in the 1800s, as these savages are killing white landowners, raping white women. And so if you look at the images from the early 1800s, that's what you see of Haiti, that these are like violent savages that can't that can't really rule themselves. And that image has really followed us over the years. So even if you know, if there was a shooting and two people got killed, it becomes huge, as opposed to the mass shootings we have in the U.S. every day, right? It doesn't make the news. And part of that is already baked into the worldview, including other countries outside of Europe, because that's the images that they're fed.
What needs to happen, in your opinion, to turn the situation around in Haiti?
It is complex. And I do talk about this, that people think, oh, Haiti is so difficult, so complex, and we don't know what to do. It's actually not that complex. What Haitians want is the UN to get out of their country. The UN is not, the UN is not a democratic institution. It has five core members that make all the decisions, and the five core members are mostly from the West. You know, they finally opened it up to China and Russia. But the UN is not a democratic institution, and we are under occupation. So the Haitian people want the U.S., the UN to get out. They want the U.S. to remove, take down this puppet prime minister that they put in place that they don't want, because it's under this puppet prime minister that's allowing all of these things to happen. And I have to say, there's illegal mining going on in Haiti. These puppet governments have basically signed over all of Haiti's mineral resources, and the country's rich with mineral resources. There are oil companies drilling right on the outskirts of the island. And so we have to think about the fact that if Haiti is so poor, why is it that every day there are like four flights from Miami, Florida to Haiti filled with white businessmen going to Haiti to make money, right? So there's that. And so what Haitians want is they want this so-called, this prime minister that's implicated, by the way, in the assassination of the president, right? And the U.S. knows that. The U.S. has all the evidence. They want the prime minister to come down. They want the U.N. to leave Haiti. And they want the space for Haitian, they always say this, Haitian solution. And, you know, before Jovenel Moïse was the president that was assassinated, before he was assassinated in July, there are a bunch of groups that came together in February 2021. And, you know, it was like a coalition for, you know, coming up with a Haitian solution. And there are several groups, one's called the Montana Group, that basically laid out a plan, a two-year plan for the transitional government, elections, and so on. Well, the U.S. refused to take heed. And not only did they refuse to take heed, they managed to actually, incorporate some of these individuals, right, managed to get them so that they could basically follow through and then try to gain favor with the U.S. And so then that basically just took out all the active radical elements from the group, and basically the group just was destroyed. And so now the U.S. is talking about a Haitian solution, but it's handpicked it has handpicked those who are supposed to come up with a Haitian solution. So what we need is to be left alone. These people need to leave us alone. They need to leave the country, leave us alone, and we will figure it out. And we're not even being allowed to do that. They won't leave. You know, they won't leave the country. They won't stop, you know, intervening. And until they do, it's going to be a mess. And I think at this point, Haitians have had it. And I think they're willing to continue protesting. And I have to also say, these current protests have been going on for 6 weeks, but you would never know that, right? Because you would never know that they've been protesting, asking the UN to leave.
Wow, really interesting. Dr. Pierre, do you have any final comments for our viewers?
Well, I just want to say, I hope people watching this will take the time and understand the situation is not an exceptional situation in the sense that Haiti is so different from the rest of us, the rest of the world who are suffering from Western imperialism. And so if we understand Haiti and Haitian people as real human beings, not just, you know, these people who won a revolution 200 years ago, real human beings with real needs and need to have access to their own sovereignty and their self-determination, I hope the rest of the world will join us in that fight against the Western imperialism that is really holding, you know, that is keeping us under their boot.
All right, and we hope the same thing. Thanks so much for being with us here on the program, Dr. Pierre. The story of Haiti is one of a country with so much potential, so many resources, but one which has been sabotaged. Many of its members of its upper class have worked in cahoots with Western governments to steal all they can and to create chaos on the island. The real story is the wealth that has been stolen that needs to be returned. This is another story of colonialists and imperialists being held responsible and made to repay what they've stolen, though they can never really repay it. It is estimated that currently France should repay at least $120 billion for the money that it extorted from Haiti. And then the United States should be held responsible for its theft and causing instability in Haiti. There are groups that are taking these demands for reparations to the international community, but will it make a difference? What we know is that the Haitian people are revolutionary and resilient, and we hope that while they are on the streets demanding justice, that this will ultimately lead to their real independence and empowerment. Well, like all of our other files we've mentioned, we will continue to follow up on Haiti, the affluent nation, which has been impoverished and demonized, with the hope that the Haitian people will ultimately get what they deserve. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinian resistance fighters engage in heavy fighting with Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip, destroying 24 of their armored vehicles in the south and north of the territory. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the Israeli onslaught